Thanks, Brother Stu, and good afternoon, brothers and sisters and young people. We come to our third study, and we said in our opening study that as we journey with Elisha, that we will, in a sense, be going into the home of every brother and sister in the ecclesia. And that's what we're going to be doing for the next two studies. We're going to be looking into the private lives of some members of that 7,000 who did not bow the knee to Baal. And we'd have to have a heart of stone, brothers and sisters and young people, if we weren't touched by the experiences of these people that we're going to read of in these next three studies. We're going to see how the man of God continued his work of comforting and edifying that remnant that remained in the land. You know, this woman's faith, the woman that we've read of, this Shunammite woman this afternoon, she's a towering giant when you think about her. It's so easy to read over some of these accounts and think, okay, that's what happened. But pause and think, brothers and sisters, this was a real event. This woman experienced the loss of her son, her husband, her land, and her house. And at the end of all of that, she still believed that God was righteous. That's remarkable. Can we think of anyone else who has endured such suffering in the Old Testament? Selah. What she would have endured was enough to crush the spirit and the faith of many. We're not told how old she was. It would appear she wasn't as old as her husband. Her husband is described as being old in verse 14. Her husband is old. But this woman was able to carry a young child up the stairs to a loft. And if she was old like her husband, we would think that that would have been recorded as an impediment to the two of them having children, but it's not. So it would seem that she was a bit younger than her husband. We're not told about the names of the people either, and it's as though this story is meant to have age-abiding principles. The incident provides not only an example of faith in adversity, we're going to see that it brings us a lot closer to the man of God. And as we may have recognized already, there's quite a contrast between this woman and the widow woman that's mentioned in the earlier part of chapter 4. Now, there's a little expression that occurs in this chapter, and it occurs only in this chapter, in three places, and you might say it forms natural divisions within the chapter, and it's the little expression, "It fell on a day." And it occurs in verses 8, 11, and 18. And so the events within those 3 days, if you like, are like this. On the first day, fellowship is formed between Elisha and the woman. On the second day, a son is born. And on the third day, the son dies and is resurrected. And so on each day, there's some providential event that takes place that shaped the life of this woman. In chapter 8, there's a sequel to this story. We're not going to deal with chapter 8. We'll mention it in passing. But the woman goes before the king and she receives her land back. We'll have a little bit more to say about that later. In verse 8 of the chapter that we had read for us this afternoon, we're told that this woman lived in Shunem, and hence she's called a Shunammite. And that the place where she lived becomes, if you like, an epithet of the woman. She's the Shunammite. Shunem means quietly. It's from a root to rest. And it was on the north side of the Jezreel Valley, almost directly opposite Jezreel. We learn quite a bit about this woman's husband in the record, and we can piece together a few things about us. What we do know is that he seems to have been disengaged so far as the truth is concerned. What we do know is that the woman was more willing and able to meet the needs of others. She constrained Elisha to eat bread. She perceived that he was a holy man of God. She thought of the idea of making him a lodging place. She cared for the child when it became ill. She travelled to get help. She received the child back again. So her husband is presented as being disinterested and dispassionate. And so we read this in verse 8. And it fell on a day that Elisha passed to Shunem, where was a great woman, and she constrained him to eat bread. And so it was that as oft as he passed by, he turned in thither to eat bread. Just to help us sort of visualize where Shunem is. Some of you know the geography of the land. You will know that this here is the Jezreel Valley. It runs from the Mediterranean all the way down till it intersects with the Jordan Valley, which runs north-south. So the Jezreel Valley, if you like, runs in this northwesterly direction. So here is Shunem on the northern side of the valley, and almost directly opposite is Jezreel. And later in the chapter, we're going to read, later in the class rather, we're going to see how the woman and Elisha come from Mount Carmel down to Shunem. So they would have made this journey down here, a journey probably of around 3 hours. Now, we read that Elisha passed by Shunem. And what it seems is that Elisha spent some time in the area of Carmel and also further south with the sons of the prophets. So as you can see, he would have used the opportunity to pass by Shunem. In fact, it says to pass over to Shunem, more correctly. And we might ask, why is that? Well, perhaps because Jezreel had been the home of that wicked Jezebel and also was the residence for a time of Jehoram, the wicked prince of Israel. So perhaps it was that Elisha made a bit of a detour around Jezreel to avoid that place of wickedness. Got a picture here. This is taken from Jezreel, looking sort of north in a northwesterly direction to Shunem. So we're standing here at Jezreel. There's a view across the valley to Shunem over here. So you can see it's one of the fertile areas of the country, and the valley itself is relatively flat. But the thing that I want to convey to you is that this woman, this faithful woman, raised a godly seed right under the nose of the prince, the wicked prince of Israel. We're told she's a great woman. Her greatness, in the first place, I would say, relates to her wealth. She had servants. And what we're told is that she constrained Elisha, in verse 8, to eat bread. In other words, to have a meal with him. Now, that word constrained there in verse 8 is a strong word. It means to fasten upon, hence to seize. And it's used in Genesis 19 of the instance where the angels came and rescued Lot, and they fastened hold of him and took him out of the city of Sodom. So this woman made a concerted effort to get Elisha to have a meal with her and her husband. And as a result of that, providing that hospitality, we read in verse 9, and she said unto her husband, behold now, I perceive that this is an holy man of God, which passeth by us continually. And how true it is, brothers and sisters, that hospitality turns ecclesias into families. And this woman came to know Elisha very well as a result of extending hospitality to him. The fact that the woman didn't know the identity of this man tells us that her motives were pure in offering hospitality. And we know the words well, be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware. And you know what? This woman never forgot to entertain because she made a habit of it. You think, brothers and sisters and young people, if you were alone, how good would it be if you knew that every Thursday you were going to be invited to someone's home and that was a regular thing? How would you feel? You would love it, wouldn't you? I'd suggest that you would probably look forward to that day of the week when you could spend time with someone and you knew that the next week the same thing was going to happen. This woman made a habit of hospitality. You know, Paul says that an arranging brother must be given to hospitality. Given to hospitality. Why is that? It's listed with other moral credentials, if you like, of an arranging brother. And we tend to think, well, you know, they're sort of in categories. There's, you know, upstanding, integrity, husband of one wife, and sort of hospitality is a, you know, a more of an optional thing. It's not, brothers and sisters. And I'd have to confess, I haven't always lived up to that myself. But there's a reason for it. A shepherd needs to know his sheep. And one of the best ways of doing that is having people back in your home. This verse also tells us something about the character of Elisha. It's apparent that the woman didn't know his identity. Otherwise, she would have already known at the outset that he was a holy man of God. And so it's clear that when Elisha met her, that he didn't, we might say, flash his ecclesial business card, so to speak. This man was a self-effacing man. His character spoke for itself. What was the quality of Elisha that she identified in verse 9? Behold now, I perceive that this is an holy man of God. Now, I think it's a shame, brothers and sisters and young people, that the word holy, or at least the meaning that we attach to the word holy today, has actually morphed over time. And the meaning that we generally attach to it is really just a subset of the idea of what holiness involves. We tend to just simply say that holiness is separateness. And that's not untrue, but the point is that it only describes part of the meaning of holiness. Now, the idea of holiness comes from the New Testament word hagios, which is translated holiness. It has the idea of separateness or a way of life befitting someone who is separate. But the word in the Old Testament, kadosh, is quite different. It means to be pure or devoted. So the point is this. It's possible to be separate in God's sight, but not holy. You see, holiness isn't just keeping distance from bad influences. Holiness is separating ourselves from the world to be devoted to God. And a person who is holy is a person who sees everything through the eyes of a servant. And that was the quality that this woman was able to perceive in Elisha. Now, we're told that the woman perceived that he was a holy man of God, and of course that then sort of fueled her desire to support him in his work. So hospitality then was extended to providing a place of lodging. This woman perceived not only the man's character, but also his needs. And so she goes to some length to provide accommodation. It included, we're told in verse 10, we might read it, "Let us make a little chamber, I pray thee, on the wall. Let us set for him there a bed, a table, and a stool, and a candlestick. And it shall be that when he cometh to us, that he shall turn in thither." So we're given all the details of this room, which really, you know, aren't essential for us to know. There's, of course, significance in these things. Now, the chamber that we read of there, it's the word alia, which means to something lofty, that is, a stairway, also a second-story room. The same word is rendered loft in 1 Kings chapter 17. And of course, we will be familiar with the fact that what we're reading of this incident this afternoon is very similar to the circumstances of Elijah in 1 Kings 17. So the word rendered loft in 1 Kings 17 is the same word rendered chamber here. We're told in verse 21 that she went up and laid the child on the bed. So this was, if you like, a room that was built on the outer perimeter of the roof of the house, and it had an external staircase. Now, in this chamber was not only a bed, but was other furniture as well. A table, a stool, and a candlestick, or in other words, a lampstand. So it's clear that she intended this room to be used for more than just accommodation. The woman wanted the man of God to abide with her. Now, there's something interesting about the furniture in this room. The table, the stool, and the lamp. Now, the word the word that's rendered table here is used for pretty much all sorts of tables, so there doesn't appear to be anything distinctive about the table, but there is so far as the stool and the lamp are concerned. They are special. The word rendered stool is a Hebrew word, kiseh. It means a seat with a canopy. It's most commonly rendered throne, and it's never used of a conventional seat. It is always used of a seat of a king or a dignitary. Likewise, the word rendered candlestick is the word menorah, which Gesenius has this to say. It's always used of the great candlestick which stood in the tabernacle of witness. What's it telling us? That this woman saw in Elisha qualities befitting a king and a priest. And so she furnished the room in a way that honoured the view that she had of him. And that, of course, stood in contrast to the corrupt rulers and priesthood of the northern kingdom. And so Elisha was content to dwell with her because he could see likewise that she was a godly woman. And the words perhaps of John come to mind. If a man love me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come unto him and make our abode with him. So a routine became established whereby the man of God would turn into her house, find safe haven and rest for his soul in the quiet town of Shunem, which means rest. And as we said, all of that happened right under the nose of the Prince of Israel. Now, you recall that we observed how the chapter is divided up by this little expression, it fell on a day. On the first day, fellowship was established. And now in verses 11 to 17, we enter the second day. And in this section, a child is promised and born. And it begins with Elijah reflecting on the kindness that this woman had showed to him. And so what then ensues is three conversations. The first is between Elisha and the woman via Gehazi. The second between Elisha and Gehazi. And the third between Elisha and the woman directly. From verse 10, we learn what the woman had done in providing the chamber and all the furniture. But in verse 13, which are the words of Elisha through Gehazi, we learn how they were done and with what attitude. Verse 13, and he said unto him, say now unto her, behold, thou hast been careful for us with all this care. What is to be done for thee? You know, that word careful is a really intense word. It means to shudder with terror. And if you can visualize Isaac when he had blessed the boys, or when he had blessed Jacob, and then he realized that he hadn't blessed the person that he thought he had blessed, he shuddered with terror. That's the same word here that's used to describe the carefulness that this woman went to for Elisha. Once again, it further illustrates how highly esteemed the man of God was in the sight of this woman. And so in verse 13, Elisha offers to speak to the king or captain of the host on her behalf. And a response comes in verse 13. I dwell among mine own people. It was her way of saying, thank you, but I'm content. How wonderful is that? Paul says, godliness with contentment is great gain. And her aspirations of being a mother had long passed, and she had accepted her lot in life. So there's a dilemma. What is to be done for her? And hence ensues this second conversation between Elisha and Gehazi, verse 14. And he said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered, verily, she hath no child, and her husband is old. It said she has no child and her husband is old. That word old there is the same word used in Genesis 18 verse 12, where it describes Abraham at the time when he had Isaac. And concerning that conception, Paul says, and being not weak in faith, he considered not his own body now dead. So this man was in the same state as what Abraham was. His body was now dead. From a natural point of view, he was not capable of fathering a child because of his age. However, when you think about it, the inability of this couple to have a child would suggest that the woman too was incapable of having children due to barrenness. Because if that wasn't the case, we would expect that earlier in their married life, they could have had a child. And so the third conversation takes place, this time directly between Elisha and the woman. So in verses 15 and 16, again she is called. She climbs the stairs to the loft and stands in the door, where she receives from Elisha the promise in verse 16. And he said, about this season, according to the time of life, thou shalt embrace a son. And she said, nay, my lord, thou man of God, do not lie unto thine handmaid. He doesn't just say, you're going to have a son. He says, you're going to embrace a son. What empathy there is in that, and what warmth there is in that. He knew what this was going to mean to that woman. The response of the woman is, don't lie to me. Don't lift me up with such expectations. I know what that feels like. I've been there before. She doesn't want to experience disappointment again. He says, according to the time of life, she would have the child. That expression, according to the time of life, is only used in one other place in Scripture, and it's in Genesis chapter 18. And he said, I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life, and Sarah thy wife shall have a son. And so that provides an indication that the woman was barren. More importantly, it tells us what the basis was of the promise, that it was faith comparable to that of Sarah. And so we read in verse 17 that the son of promise is born, and the woman conceived and bare a son at that season that Elisha had said unto her, according to the time of life. Isn't that wonderful, brothers and sisters? It brings to mind the words of Psalm 113. He maketh the barren woman to keep house and to be a joyful mother of children. Praise ye Yahweh. So you can imagine what life on the farm would have been like for the next 5 or so years. This joyful mother delighted in the new addition to her family. The child had reached the age of around 5 when he was old enough to go to his father, yet he wasn't so heavy that his mother couldn't carry him. So we'd suggest he was around 5 years of age, when that joy was to be abruptly interrupted. In verses 18 to 21, we have described the tragedy that suddenly hit this little family who had been blissfully enjoying parenthood. And you know, one of the things that I find is a consistent theme in Scripture, brothers and sisters and young people, is this, that we're being given a window into the life of this relatively insignificant family. I mean, how many people in the land of Israel knew of this family? And yet God singles out this little family in Shunem, and he opens the door of their house and he gives us a view into their character. And it's because of the wonderful character that they exhibited that they're chosen. And so we read in verse 18, "And when the child was grown, it fell on a day that he went out to his father to the reapers." We said how that expression portended life changing providential events. The first 2 days, if you like, were days that brought joy, but the third day was going to bring a crushing trial. On this day, the child goes to his father in the field and complains of severe head pain. And the father's response provides an insight into his character. Verse 19. "And he said unto his father, my head, my head. And he said to a lad, carry him to his mother." It's harvest time. He's busy. He doesn't want to be interrupted. Says to the servant, "Go and take the lad to his mother." It's evident that the boy was in a serious state. But the father, he doesn't follow the servant back to the house. Neither when he comes from the field back into the house does he inquire of the state of the child. He doesn't appear to share his wife's faith, but neither did he appear to share her love for her son. It says in verse 20, it describes the pitiful state of the child. "And when he had taken him, he brought him to his mother, and he sat on her knees until noon, and then died." Can you imagine having a child sitting on your knees and watching its life ebb away slowly until eventually it dies in your lap? Finally, at noon, the child expired. It's a natural and a reasonable question to ask. Why does the father allow this to happen? It seems almost cruel, doesn't it? Wouldn't it have been better for the woman not to have a child than to have had this experience? In the case of the woman, her grief was short-lived. But that is not always the case. We can all think of circumstances that ended differently. The 5-year-old daughter that one morning goes out into the backyard and plays on the swing and collapses and dies without any warning. In this story, we know how it ends. The Shunammite didn't. Let's walk in her shoes and learn from her faith. This, brothers and sisters, is one of those inescapable predicaments that we spoke about in our previous studies. By inescapable, we mean a situation where there is no human remedy. As a result, she believed that God could do what is humanly impossible. This woman's faith rose to an incredible height, and we can thank her for it. What then follows is the real reason why she was called a great woman of Shunem. Verse 21, "And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door upon him and went out." You know, if she was a lesser woman, she would have just mourned. She would have looked for comforters. What was in her mind? The man of God. She had heard how she had heard about how Elijah had raised the child of the woman of Zarephath. And that resurrection took place on Elijah's bed in a loft. So she takes the child up into the loft, leaves him on the bed, and heads off on a 30-kilometre journey to the man of God at Carmel. As we said, it would have been about a 3-hour journey on an ass, and you can imagine that would have been the longest 3 hours of her life. What would she be thinking? The big questions: why and what if? Why has God allowed this to happen? What if the man of God is not there? What if Elisha can't restore him to life? What about my faith? Do I really believe that all things are possible with God? After 3 long hours, the woman reaches Carmel and finds the man of God, and she prostrates herself and grasps his feet and says in verse 28, "Did I desire a son of my Lord? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me'? Elisha, you gave me something I didn't ask for. Now you've taken both it away and my trust in you, because you promised you wouldn't deceive me." You know, there's a force in those words that's more than just, "Elisha, come and raise my son." What was she doing? She was appealing to his character. She was appealing to his integrity. And Elisha immediately perceives her need, and he proposes to send Gehazi. But she replies, "As Yahweh liveth, and as thy soul liveth, I will not leave thee." Now, those words weren't lost on Elisha. They were the very words that he had uttered when Elijah was about to depart. And he said that he would not leave his side. Once again, the Shunammite woman appealed to what she knew about the man of God. And you know, brothers and sisters and young people, I think that's worth noting. It's one thing to appeal to God in prayer, but it's another thing to pray to him in such a way that draws upon what we know about his character. And I think that the Father delights in that, when we pray in such a way that we're drawing on what we know about his character. Daniel did that. Daniel chapter 9. "O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, hearken and do. Defer not for thine own sake, O my God, and for thy city and my people that are called by thy name." And I love the next bit. "And while he was speaking, God commanded an angel Gabriel to go to his side." So Elisha immediately accedes to her request. You know, Paul says in Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 18, in speaking of Christ, "For in that he himself hath suffered being tempted, he is able to succour them that are tempted." And do you know what that word "succour" means? It means to run to the cry. And the lexicographer Joseph Thayer gives us that meaning. And if ever there was an illustration of a man of God running to the cry, here it was. Elisha literally runs to the cry of this woman in her deep distress. So we're told in verse 31 that Gehazi passed on before them. And Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff upon the face of the child. And perhaps he was feeling that his competence had been doubted, and so he set off to prove himself. and so reaches the house first. And as Elisha and the woman near the house, Gehazi approaches them. What tidings will he bring? The look on his face said it all. The child is not awaked. Elisha's staff was to play no part in the healing of the child. It was ineffectual in the hand of Gehazi. Neither was it to be used by Elisha. Something else was to be needed. As they neared the home in the late afternoon, and keep in mind this is now a 6-hour round trip from Shunem to Carmel and back again, the shadows were lengthening as night approached. The body was now cold, totally lifeless. This wasn't going to be a matter of resuscitation. This was a test not only of the woman's faith, this was a test of Elisha's faith. No doubt Elisha would have discussed with Elijah the raising of the widow of Zarephath's son. Would God manifest such power in him? Note what verse 32 says, "And when Elisha was come into the house, behold, the child was dead and laid upon his bed." He shuts the door on the chamber. There's only himself and the child inside the chamber. Can you imagine the thoughts of the mother listening, waiting for a sound, for some indication that the child is alive? Elisha makes contact with the child, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, hands to hands. The man and the child become as one. Then life comes into the child. That oneness was what the staff of Elijah was powerless to provide. And so the child sneezed and opened its eyes and came to life. On what basis was the child raised? Let Paul answer. By faith, women receive their dead raised to life again. And there's only three instances in the Bible of a woman receiving their dead to life. Elijah and the widow of Zarephath, this record here of Elisha and the Shunammite, and of course, Jesus raising the widow of Nain's son, which was only a short distance away. There's a sequel to the story, as we said in chapter 8. In brief, the woman and her household have to leave the land because of the famine for a period of 7 years. So they're exiled, and upon their return, they find their land and their house has been overtaken by illegal tenants. At that time, her husband is not with her. Presumably, he's passed away. So she appeals to the king, and the king restores her inheritance. As we've seen with all of the miracles of Elisha, there's always a rich vein of ideas below the surface. Below the surface, and it's for us to find. So let's get our spade, brothers and sisters, and turn our mind to trying to see just what it is that the Father has hidden below the surface in this record. So where do we start to unravel the hidden meaning of this chapter or of this incident? Well, let's start with the woman because, you see, she is the key to understanding all of this parable. We've got four things. We've got a woman, a husband, a son who dies, and a son who is brought back to life. Let's start with the woman. What do we know about her? Well, firstly, she was unable to have a child by natural means. She was promised a son. This child would not be born after the flesh, but after the spirit. She would have a son according to the time of life. And as we find that expression occurs in verses 16 and 17, it's used twice here. And as we said earlier, the only other place where that expression is used is in relation to Sarah. And it's used twice there also. It's used twice of Sarah, the woman who likewise was unable to have a child by natural means and who was promised a son. So we've got a strong connection then between the woman of Shunem and Sarah, and we're going to explore that connection further. Now, to understand the significance of that connection, we need to spend a little bit of time in Galatians chapter 4. So I'd like you to turn over there to Galatians chapter 4. Now, in Galatians chapter 4, we have an allegory. It's not our intent to go into this allegory in any great depth, but just to identify a couple of important points. Let's read together Galatians chapter 4 and verses 21 to 24. Tell me, ye that desire to be under the law, do ye not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, but he of the free woman by promise, which things are an allegory. So what we find is that Paul uses an allegory to characterize two classes of people. Those classes are those that are led by the Spirit, as we read in Galatians 5 verse 18, and those that desire to be under the law, Galatians 4 verse 21. Now what Paul does is he uses a figure of a woman and a son to describe the characteristics of each class. To describe the characteristics of those who are led by the Spirit, he uses Sarah and Isaac. To describe the characteristics of those who are under the law, he uses Hagar and Ishmael. Why does he use a woman and a son to describe the characteristics of each class? Why doesn't he use just a woman or just a son? Well, because of this, that the characteristics of each class can't be adequately described by just a woman or just a son. Let's see why. So as I said, our intention is not to go into this in detail. So don't worry, we're not going to go into this in any depth. We only want to take away from this slide two things. That is, that a woman and a son together can be used to define a single concept. And the concept in this case is a class of people. The second thing we want to do is to ascertain the characteristics of this particular class of people. So let's look at the attributes of this class that are taken from the woman and the son. So what we've got is we've got two classes of people. One class is depicted by Sarah and Isaac, and they represent those who are led of the Spirit. The other class are represented by Hagar and Ishmael, and they represent those who desire to be under the law. So as I said, what we've got, the first takeaway is that a concept can be represented by a woman and a son together. And that's what we've got here, two classes of people. Now, as I said, why doesn't God just use a woman or a son? Well, because there's attributes of the class of people that come from the woman, and there's attributes of the class of people that come from the son. And we've got those depicted on these rows. So what attributes are represented by the woman? Well, for this class that are led of the Spirit, Sarah was a free woman. This class, like Sarah, serve voluntarily. What of the other class? Hagar was a bondwoman, a servant. This class, like Hagar, serve by compulsion. Well, what are the attributes that are brought by the Son. In the first instance, Isaac was born of the operation of divine power on a barren woman. This class, like Isaac, are born by the operation of divine power, that is, the Word of God. They are led by the Spirit and justified by faith. What about the other class? Ishmael was born after the flesh. This class, like Ishmael, seek to be justified by the works of the flesh. The class of people that we're interested in is this one. Why? Because the Shunammite and her son together represent this class of people. So let's start piecing it together. Here's what we know about the Shunammite. She was unable to have a child by natural means. She was promised a son. She was told she would have the son according to the time of life, and she inherits the land without her husband. She represents the free woman of Galatians chapter 4. Well, what about the man? Remember in 2 Kings 4, when the woman made known her intention to travel to the man of God for help, he replied, "Wherefore wilt thou go to him today? It's neither new moon or Sabbath." He features in Galatians 4 as well, if you've still got Galatians 4 open. Paul says in Galatians 4 verse 10, "Ye observe days and months and times and years." That describes the husband. He represents the law. So what about the son? As we said, the woman and the son together represent a class of people who are born of the Spirit, serve voluntarily, and are justified by faith. The son of the free woman includes both Jew and Gentile, and so it is in the parable. But how can one son, the son of the Shunammite woman, represent both Jew and Gentile? Well, let's see. Let's consider, first of all, the son born in the house. He was a child of promise. He was born in the house on account of the faith of the woman. He was subject to the father, the law, but could not be saved by him. He represents a spiritual Jew. How are we to understand the death of the child? A child which represents a Jew born of the Spirit. Let Paul, who was of that seed, answer the question. "For I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died." In other words, the law brought death to even a spiritually minded person like Paul. "Therefore, by the deeds of the law shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin." So if the son that died represents the spiritual Jews, where do the spiritual Gentiles fit in? Well, remember that the woman put the dead child in the chamber. However, when Elisha arrives, note what it says, if we go back to 2 Kings chapter 4. Back in 2 Kings chapter 4, when Elisha arrives, this is what we read. "And when Elisha was come into the house," note it doesn't say he went into the chamber. He went into the house. So the chamber is now presented as being part of the house. The house has been extended to include a Gentile son. The child was brought to life in the extended house. And in describing that extended house, Isaiah 54 and verse 2 says, "Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitations. Spare not, lengthen thy cords, and strengthen thy stakes. For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles, and make the desolate cities to be inhabited." And as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 19, "Now therefore, ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God." This child was brought to life in the extended house. He was once dead. He represents the Gentiles who were dead in trespasses and sins. But God, who is rich in mercy, for his great love wherewith he loved us, even when we were dead in sins, hath quickened us together with Christ. By grace are ye saved. So how did this quickening process take place? How was the child brought to life? You see, this Gentile son identified with Christ. Elisha put eye to eye, mouth to mouth, hands to hands. They became as one. But there's more. The child came to life after sneezing seven times. Seven is the number of the covenant. Now, when a person sneezes, they inhale air, and it signifies intaking of the spirit of the covenant that brings about new life. And exhaling is the outward expression of that which is taken in. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 11 and 12 says, "That at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world." Hence, the child brought to life in the extended house by the operation of the Spirit represents those Gentiles who embrace the Abrahamic covenant, thereby becoming sons of promise. And notice this, that through the record in chapter 4, the boy is referred to as a child. We've got that in verses 29, 31, 32, 34, 35. And as soon as he opened his eyes, he's now a son. You know, Paul says God had called him to open their eyes, to turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan unto God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and inheritance among them which are sanctified by faith that is in me. And the receiving of that inheritance that Paul speaks of is prefigured in chapter 8. When the woman and the son come before the king evicts the illegal tenants and secured an inheritance for the woman and her son. Well, what are the takeaways for the nation? Israel mistakenly thought that they were God's people. Hosea was later to write, "Ye are not my people, and I will not be your God." The question is then, who are the true Israelites? The answer, they are not all Israel, which are of Israel. They which are the children of the flesh, these are not the children of God, but the children of the promise are counted for the seed. And so what can we take away? What's the exhortation we can take away, brothers and sisters, from this remarkable example of faith of this woman of Shunem? The Shunammite raised a godly seed despite her husband being disengaged. Her unshakable belief that God could do what was humanly impossible, saved her son. Our Lord himself hath suffered being tempted, therefore he is able to run to the cry of them that are tempted. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of promise. Let us ensure that our identification with Christ is eye to eye, mouth to mouth, hand to hand.